Hey, everybody, welcome to the Business Beyond Performance podcast. My name is Matt Powell. With me, as always, is brand new dad, looking dapper and amazingly delicious and delicatessen. Joe Stahl, how are you?
Where are you going with that?
I'm not even going to lie to you. I don't know. I just kind of started going, brother.
I gave you so much shit in the last one. I was expecting just a whole pile on right now.
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm trying to take the high road, you know, because I'm so used to you dragging me down. I'm just trying to go up. So I think it's important to mention right now for all the listeners, you know, however many there are, that you are in that brand new baby stage, right? That first few weeks. I am in like that sleep regression first few month phase, and we are both just sucked in right now. So this is a fun time, dude. I'm excited.
I could close my eyes and be asleep as I'm talking if I wanted to right now. And it's not only am I a new dad, it's my third kid. So I got a 5-year-old, I got a 2-year-old, and I got a 14-day-old.
You are just an amazing man, and I appreciate everything you do. So you know what helped me right now, actually, is some mental toughness, which is one of Dr. Brandon Orr's least favorite things to say ever. Mm-hmm. As a performance psychology or mental performance coach, whatever the correct term you want to use, depending upon what part of the country you're in or the world for that matter. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Brandon Orr works with AFSOC now. He's previously at the University of Missouri. He's worked at a couple other different places as well with his coaching. He was also a former college football coach, and that's actually where his basis began. Started to use his psychology degree to start doing different things, and then he went a whole different path. Instead of being X's and O's and on the field, he wanted to look simply at the mental performance, the mental coaching, the mental preparation of how athletes or high performers like special operations can work to make themselves a better fit into their, you know, not only group, but also within their family, within their different communities, on their other parts of their life. He is definitely one of those big holistic people that you have to step back and listen to and just let him kind of roll. So, Joe, what'd you think, man?
No, so never met the guy, to be totally honest, didn't even know who he was, didn't even know the name at first. So just to be able to jump in, get high-level conversation, you know, we zigged and zagged in a couple different areas, both on the business side and kind of his journey transitioning from sport coach to now, you know, kind of, you know, in the performance realm, depending on which way you look at it from the mental strength side, mental performance side, and then also just the business stuff, you know, all the other things he's got going on. And then also balancing life. So he's just, you know, I like the thing most about him is that he's just a really intense guy who is real dialed in with what he wants, what he's trying to do. You know, you don't always find people who are like real dialed in on like, this is who I am. This is what I'm good at. This is why I'm here. This is what I am doing. And I am doing it. You know, you don't always find that. So that's what I like the most was how he's just dialed in he is.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody that I'm super glad we brought on, even though he may not have the name recognition yet that some of the other people do. He's doing a really good job putting himself out there on social media, LinkedIn, things like that. So I do think his name recognition will grow. I think that no matter what, though, whether it does or not, his information and what he brings across and what he brings to the interview and to the table is definitely going to be something really good. So moving on, let's go to episode number 23, Dr. Brandon Orr. Hey, everybody, what's going on? This is Matt and Joe from the Business Beyond Performance podcast, and I'd like to welcome our guest today, Brandon Orr, a gentleman who doesn't need a big introduction, not only because he doesn't want it, but also because as we're sitting here and we're going over his resume, it's impressive. This man was at University of Missouri, and he was out there teaching, educating, doing the sports performance and the performance enhancement from a mental standpoint and director of positive coaching, and then he went on to AFSOC, where he's now working as a tactical space, working with those different gentlemen out there. So Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thanks for letting me into your space and excited to see where this thing takes us. And hopefully we don't detour too much.
Well, from the way we talked before we even came on camera, I'm pretty sure we are destined to go that way.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah. No question about it. So give us your quick 30-second overview of kind of where you were, how you got into the space, and kind of what you're doing now.
Yeah, it started for me with, I had a defensive back. He was the top recruit in the country. It's Division II, right? So you don't find often with the way we taught bump and run and the way we put our guys on the island, man, you don't find a lot of true freshmen that out of the gate can play bump and run like that. And we had a game up in Michigan Tech, and we were one of those like 16 to 13 games, and they're driving and driving and driving. They score, there's just not enough time. And we left him on an island that entire series and just played 10 on 10 and said, you take care of him. Unbelievably talented. As we pushed into the offseason, it became, you know, Grey Goose and marijuana for him. And I'm looking at a kid who's just wasting his talent, thinking this is my responsibility to fix this. And I spent that whole summer before training camp in Barnes & Noble, just absolutely obsessed with trying to understand the mind and motivation and what could I do and how could I prime and pull. And I think that really started the fascination for me with the psychological universe that accompanies performance. And that led to the PhD. I felt like it was a better utilization of my skill set, honestly. I kind of missed that mental priming philosophically that is endemic to psychology. So that kind of led me to that path. And I think the easiest way to say it in a 30-second wrap is I have just since then been obsessed and fascinated with the psychological universe that accompanies performance, but man, specifically elite performance, right? The special warfare, spec ops, SOF, national champion, Olympian, professional, like that space where, man, it is just the minute details of technique and the minute details of execution, which are often primed psychologically, that it's just fascinating to get to be a part of it.
I love that you can go back to that one specific moment and say, this is when I knew, this is my deal. Took you obviously 4, 5, 6, 7 years more education, right? To be at the level you want to be at, but you did a fantastic job of going to that one event. Where were you coaching at when that happened?
That was Northwood University in the GLIAC. And so we were, you know, Grand Valley State, Saginaw Valley State. We had a ridiculous roster. We had a monster of a defensive coordinator in Adam Gonzaga. I learned so much from that man about the process and grinding and, man, just being dedicated to your craft. I owe so much to him and how tenacious I am in my preparation in any domain. And this little known Division II, just throttling Grand Valley State, throttling Saginaw Valley State. And we had that true, you know, that blue collar that's become kind of cliche now, but we were straight blue collar. I mean, we ran the Navy midline option. We did not have stud recruits. We didn't have great facilities and money. We just were nasty and hustled. And it was an identity that everybody on that team absorbed. And we got after it and had some runs at Grand Valley, had some runs at Saginaw Valley. We were top 10. Division II playoffs 4 years in a row. It was a great run.
That's awesome. So as you kind of look back now, do you see all those exact same things and how you do things now? I know you kind of touched on that real quick. You said, hey, we're blue collar. Hey, we did this really well. I learned this from the DC, right? So what have you been able to kind of take and continue to build on and kind of understand more of why those things work and kind of how did you make that transition?
The biggest thing that we talked about was the process dictates the outcome. And this was something that I had to fail at it in order to really truly learn it. We talked about it as a mantra defensively. And it was because we had a couple of guys from that team that went to the NFL. We had a guy who was the CFL MVP for 4 or 5 years. I mean, just massively talented team. And those guys, you know, they start to know that they've arrived. And they want to pull back a little bit. They want to take a day off. They don't want to do spring ball. And our D coordinator was like, the process dictates the outcome. And with language that is, you know, familiar to us, but not applicable here, he just hammered those dudes. And that was the mantra. And so if they weren't doing it on the field, then they weren't going to be seen, because you got to do it at practice to have a chance to do it in the game. And he did not care who you were, what your credentials were, didn't care. Just ran an iron hammer. And the piece for me, this was the mistake that I made when I came in. They brought me in to fix their back end. They were the worst defensive backfield in the conference. They were awful. So it brings me in to fix it. And that's, we hammered on that ego piece, man. Y'all suck. Like, we didn't say that, but we are the worst. So if we continue with what we've done before, we're going to be the worst again. And that is unacceptable on this team. There's got to be some pride here that on a nationally ranked top 10 team, you're the worst entity on the team. So we hammered that whole year. And then, man, we got it fixed. We went from last to first in a year. It was an awesome turnaround. But guess what happens? We get to spring ball. And, you know, you start to see change of speed pursuing the ball. If you guys know what I'm talking about, you're that backside corner. And you've got that back running. And they think he's going to get tackled. So they throttle down. And then he doesn't get tackled. And you see a change of speed. That was a huge no-no for me. That's a lack of effort in LOE. And it, change of speeds are unacceptable. You get to the ball, and that's that. You would see guys not fighting in one-on-one or in seven-on-seven or being out of position on bump and run or off man, and they would constantly say to me, "Coach, you know I'm good for that. You know I got that." And I'm like, the hell's going on here? And so finally, we just had this come-to-Jesus meeting, our third day of spring ball. And I just laid it out. We're not running to the ball. You're getting beaten off, man. You're getting beaten bump and run. You're getting beaten 7-on-7. You're getting beaten live. And all you guys ever tell to me is, "Coach, you know we're good for it." And it ultimately came back on me. I had lost that process dictates the outcome. I was so focused on us just not being the worst secondary in the country or being the best in the conference that I didn't reinforce that motivational climate. And that's on me. So
unpacking some of that, right? Taking that ownership for you as a coach, huge step in the right direction, right? Your boys probably started to see that. But real quick, just because I know how DBs are, being a former safety and linebacker at a D1 university over at Temple. So are you trying to say that DBs are different? Are you trying to say they're a little cockier and a little harder to deal with sometimes, and maybe they aren't always on top of things?
I would say that. Yeah. I would say often that you have to be that way. When you're on an island like that, and you know, at the end of the day, Tom Brady is looking at you, and I get this is an elevated example, but he's very clear about it. If there's a guy that he knows on the other side is known as the guy, he wants to go after him. Well, and then the other piece of it is like 3-by-1. 3-by-1 puts you in a bind. And you know, if you're on the backside of 3-by-1, there's a damn good chance they're coming after you. And you've got to be comfortable with that responsibility. And if you're living your life based off of outcomes, right? And your confidence or your belief is tethered to outcomes, well, you're in a lonely spot of the DB. So yeah, I think there's a spot of that where they don't live in reality. It's like, bro, you just 100%. Got blasted for a 60-yard fade route. Like, what? Why are you talking shit right now?
I'm good. I'm coming back. I got the next play. I'm good for that.
Just get some Gatorade and fill up your mouth so I don't have to hear you talk.
Absolutely. So have you been able to take some of that, right? That mentality, that ability to kind of next play or, you know, forget and quick memory, whatever term you want to use there, you know, all the cliches that DB coaches or defensive coaches in general use. Have you been able to take some of that and apply it not only to your time at, you know, at Missouri, and then also to your time with AFSOC and kind of working with those guys?
Yeah, look, the thing with Missouri that was so helpful is often in that space of coach education, you know, there's going to be a de-emphasis of winning, right? It, for whatever reason, winning's become super villainous. And so, you know, we've got sport development, we've got human development, and, you know, they're people first and you should be invested in them as people. And I'm looking around myself, my coaches, the people that I coached, the people who are like-minded, and I'm like, who would that message resonate with? Nobody. So it was nice to have a pedigree from a coaching standpoint where I could come in and say, no, look, number one, winning matters. What really matters next to that, how do you conduct yourself while you're pursuing winning? because I don't think in the name of positive coaching or student athlete well-being, like I don't think in any way we have to minimize winning at all. How many people pop off about how much they can't stand Nick Saban? He's got to be doing something right. His dudes don't get in trouble. They all get drafted. And the biggest sign, Drake Kirkpatrick just brought his son back to Bama on a recruiting trip. Those dudes clearly know that he cares, that they're going to be held to a high level, and they want to be associated with the program afterwards. You can't say that about every Division I Power Five, plain and simple. So that was important to me, was to have a message that coaches would resonate with and then have a framework from lived experience and then the theoretical and conceptual frameworks that could help them make winning important, but ethically and morally pursue it. Where it led in terms of AFSW, special warfare, it's so different because you're watching dudes in a training pipeline for assessment and selection of what is largely regarded, and I'm sure we all regard our pipeline as the hardest, but what is largely regarded as one of the hardest pipelines in the world.
And longest for sure. You guys cover so much different
crap. 130 days.
No. My guys wouldn't. Yeah. No comment. Never mind. Yeah. No comment.
Yep. And I know distinctly what's on the back end. I know what ANS looks like. When we started talking this way to the studs, our students, we call them studs, we had seen what it took to be in the top 40, which was basically a selectable range, what it obviously took to be outside that selectable range and how delicate that balance of 35 to 50 was, where you're being separated by a bad event. You're being separated by a bad day. You're being separated by bad nonverbal to an operational cadre. Like it's so minute to where they don't trust you. They think they're doing fine and it's just, it's just buddy breathing. It was buddy breathing with Sergeant Neely. Like nobody passes that. I'm like, okay, well, every day at ANS is buddy breathing with Sergeant Neely. And the big piece that we would always talk about, there was a moment every class that came in where I said, I wish I had a scoreboard. I don't like sport. I'm done with that life. I don't want anything to do with sport anymore. But I know that there was one intrinsic value of sport. There was a scoreboard that read, them 37, us 17. Them 63, us 7. Us 49, them 3. And we had this tangible piece that could speak to where we were at on an outcome level. So that's kind of the way that it came full circle and full center between the two environments. And
so it sounds like you're mostly process-based or almost all completely process-based. What are some of the other main, kind of cognitive performance routes you take in order to reach your guys? What are some of your main tenets? What are your beliefs, if you will?
Sure. The core framework for me is resilience. I can get way off on that, so I won't even go down that range because we'll be 63 minutes into this thing and I'll still be talking about resilience. If resilience is Bradley Cooper, okay, and I'm like, I don't know, Lady Gaga, like it's an unhealthy obsession with the construct, but it all starts with resilience. Okay. And it very simple. It's a positive adaptation to challenge or resistance or disruption of the pursuit of a valued end. And that critical piece is a positive adaptation because it makes it facilitative. It has to be facilitative. So from there, we understand then, okay, psychophysiologically, what's happening when stress comes in? And if we just coterminously call it anxiety, then it's just a cognitive interruption, right? I'm asking you to buddy breathe. I'm asking you to drown proof. I'm asking you to do an underwater. I'm asking you to CQB. I'm asking you to fast rope. Like there's anxiety in all of that, but there's also environmental constraint, task constraint, human constraint in terms of being evaluated by cadre. Like there's so many pieces here, but ultimately it just boils down to a task-directed focus and the way that stress occupies my cognition so that ultimately I am not attention management to the task. I'm on something else. And so that resilience piece was critical. 12,000 to 80,000 is what we generally understand about how many thoughts we have a day. Okay. So I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling nervous. I'm feeling doubtful. I'm feeling stressed. I'm filling the blank, right? And so often, and I don't understand why, but so often in this career field, the coaching technique is to tell them to choose different thoughts. Wait, no, don't be confident. Hey, no. Like, hey, don't think that. Think right. And it's so dismissive. I will argue ethically, you're wrong to tell somebody that the way that they're thinking is wrong. Because now it's like, okay, well, what's thinking right? Okay, well, think like Joe because Joe's the best. Like, I don't understand that. And there's so much energy that's spent trying to control or reduce or eliminate certain thoughts that it has just been a much easier space for me in this environment as well as previous environments in terms of athletic performance to just accept that a thought is a thought and an emotion is an emotion, that it requires no judgment whatsoever. And I can just accept that when I'm doing underwaters, I think or feel this. That when I'm doing CQB, that I think or feel this. And to train myself for that task-directed focus, to have that attention management on exactly the performance behaviors related to a successful execution of insert task A. So resilience, acceptance, commitment, mindfulness, but I don't call it mindfulness because that's the quickest way to lose the room. And all mindfulness is a task-directed focus. So I'm not trying to go, I'm not trying to go Bushido or some Eastern thing on them. It's like, look, man, it's just task-directed focus. And from there, there's a whole conceptual and then applied psych skills domains that enter into the equation. But the foundation is resilience, acceptance, commitment, and mindfulness, acceptance, commitment.
So that was awesome, first of all. I love that breakdown. That was a fantastic overview while still getting it deepened up. Just great answer. Yep. So that being said, my immediate thought, because I'm a perennial hustler, right? Much like yourself, I know you got a million different side hustles. You do a bunch of different stuff, which is like I said, we vibe on that for sure. Yeah. My question is, how do you take that and apply it to entrepreneurship? How do you take that and apply it to business? How do you take that and apply it to the people who are freak selling or scared selling all their stocks right now, their Bitcoin, whatever they're into? How do you take that and apply it to that?
You know, it's perfect in my mind because I never conceptualized myself with a side hustle at all. I can't tell you why. You know, I don't know. I'm sure it's some narrative, identity-based motivation type piece that just made me reluctant to enter into that space. And man, honestly, what it was you've seen it in the tactical strength and conditioning, right? It's like hinge, push, pull, squat, and like you'll become a ranger. Like, it, come on, man. Like, we're dealing with complex problem sets here that surely aren't that simple. And that really was the impetus for me. Like, there's so much fluff out here that perfectionism is bad and think right and choose confidence and goal setting and positive self-talk. And I guess in some ways I'm not comfortable with the simple answers. That's a piece of it. But at the same time, man, I've been in deep enough spaces with some real dudes to know that if it was that simple, everybody'd be doing it and none of us would be delineated by the psychological factor. So it can't be that simple. And that frustration, and I acknowledge there's a judgment base there, but man, that frustration just said, you know what? Why not? Why not just put some counter thought out there? Accept that you're probably going to get some heat. Accept that very few people are probably going to agree with what you're saying because it's not simple. It doesn't follow the Barnes and Noble gospel. But there will be a level of people who've been looking for that depth, who will appreciate you for that depth. And that is your currency. And so that's where the acceptance and the commitment piece came in. There's a nice kind of subsidy of acceptance commitment that's called values committed action. And that's really what's been the driver for me to get out and to get into this space and to just try and have that side hustle is maximizing and authenticity are two values that drive me pretty hard. And so again, in the event that somebody's been looking for that depth and that depth is rarely espoused out there in this online ethos, why not? Why not just put it out there and see what happens? And I think that's kind of what's drawn me to the space that I'm in now.
Very cool. So as obviously I'm taking notes, right? There's so many things to hit on here and things I just, again, whether it's the way I learn them in the semantics, you know, a word here, a word there, you know, different school of thought, same idea, same concept. There is one thing that I love that you said, and I've literally preached this since the beginning in my athletic and my business career, is there's a scoreboard for a reason, because winning matters.
Yeah.
So if you keep score,
yep,
it doesn't matter how or why or what, but if score is kept, there is a very clear marker to were you successful or were you not. And that's, again, this, we could go down another rabbit hole for a couple hours on the world and that statement and yep, why score is bad or good or whatever. But
yep,
when you have one, it's a rank. And one of the things, you know, you said, you know, putting a board up and ranking people and doing stuff. That's one of the other things I've always, you know, I love the beauty of numbers. And maybe it's because I was a strength coach and I love that, you know, did you pick up 500 pounds?
Yeah. Yep.
No.
Yes.
Well, then you can't. That's it. You either did or you didn't. And the absoluteness of it takes away some of the feeling, the ambiguity, the subjectiveness. So there's some really great stuff in that. And one of the things you hit on was understanding the universe of the mind. You know, I love the way you said that. You know, you went to Barnes & Noble. So let's actually step back a little bit, because I want to get into the finance side. I want to get in to kind of some of the other things you're doing business-wise, right? Not just your subject matter expertise, yeah, but let's also talk about for a second, and this is something a lot of people listening to this can appreciate, your journey and your now mastery of a subject area. You were a sport coach, yeah, and you became something else, right? So for me, I was a strength coach and I became something else,
yeah,
right? So yeah, let's actually get to that point where was the moment, you know, you said you were in Barnes & Noble reading because you were helping your specific kid. But where was the moment you recognized that you had to, in a sense, shed one identity to move to the other one,
yeah,
because you were no longer a defensive backs coach? You know,
yeah,
I'm thinking, the reason I'm bringing this up is I'm thinking for all those people out there listening who are trying to get into a side hustle or trying to make that side hustle, they have a real business. They're trying to move beyond what limits people. And one of the things, and again, you can correct me with the right terms, is one of the things that limits people is they define themselves in their role and they can't shed it. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, in track and field, all the kids who came in talking about what they did in high school, their junior year of college, you are never going to be the guy. Sorry. You know, all the people who, you know, I've worked with in strength or in the military, you know, I'm a Green Beret or I'm a Ranger, I'm a SEAL. It's like, well, dude, you've been retired for like 10 years. What are you now? Who are you today?
Yeah.
You know, what you were is part of your story, but who you are. So let's get into that. I mean, I know I'm kind of throwing a lot out at you, but
no, let's
get into, you were that guy. And then you at some point had to realize, I can't be that guy because I'm this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. There are certain times, I think, where you're brought into conflict with cliche, and it's, The cliche because it is an overused truth, but it's an overused truth because at the heart, it's a truth. And we, in a number of different intersections, whether it's talking with the retired operator or it's talking about, man, that terrible space of an athlete that's had performance termination because of a career ending or season ending injury. You're brought into conflict with who you are, and that who you are can't be what you do. Because if it is, you are on a terminal stage of complete disruption and complete breakdown, because any identity can only be sustained for so long if it's tethered to who I am is what I do.
One of the big things I've always said to people, anyone who's worked for me, with me, whatever, is if your values aren't aligned with your actions, you are seeking catastrophe, because you can only Febreze it for so long. And again, that's my little meathead simple way of saying it, you know, that, that the common person I look at can understand. And it's just one of those things, again, however you want to find it. I know it's, we're kind of going off into a different area. This is the business beyond performance. But again, it's an important thing for people trying to become something else, to go start that business, leverage that side hustle, to really seek out change in their world, their mind, their person. You know, it can be very tough for people, and some of them can't get over themselves as the barrier to why it's not successful.
Yeah.
And so go, let run with it.
I think there's a piece here where, you know, the space that we're dealing with right now is the guy who wants to make $1 million in revenue annually, and that's the goal, right? Or they want to capture 25% of the market share, or they want to roll out 2 or 3 new products within a 18-month calendar year, and they miss on it more often than not, because that's just a goal. It's it. And there's nothing that pulls within them to make the changes within their own lives, especially within that values paradigm. It doesn't force any adaptation personally at a personal level. And it's just this thing that I'm aiming for. And you know what? I was aiming high and I didn't hit it. And, you know, that's what aiming high is for, as opposed to, no, bro, like that was 100% attainable. The reason that you didn't hit it is because there's a values conflict here, right? Or there's a complete breach between what you say your values are and what your action is. And that if we could bridge that gap, if we could close that truly intrapersonal space down, and mitigate that space and that chasm as much as possible, I promise you, through that, $1 million would come, right? Through that, whatever business goal that you have would come. Because when you're living in that intersection between values and values committed action, I have found that you don't even need a goal. You don't even need a pursuit. Like you are so much driven by just maximizing that those things naturally flow.
Yeah, they start to happen. And it's pretty interesting how the same thing, one of the, again, personal experience, I fought for it, but I wasn't smart enough to let it come to me when I should. And as soon as I had the headspace to realize there's a push and a pull, there's the give and a take, there's aligning myself for me, and then watching the rest of the pieces when I can or can't control them kind of fall into place, things just became easy. They started happening. It started rolling, and it's snowballed, and it snowballed to the point where, I mean, there are some days where I wake up and I scratch my head. I'm like, wow, like, is this really where I'm at right now? Like, that's pretty damn cool. Cause it started to happen. Yeah. So let's actually talk about that for you now. Switch gears me, right? So your sport coaching, you find that moment where you realign yourself and you move, you know, into the mental performance, mental sports psychology, all the different words we could use to describe it, depending on what level or way you're doing that work, right? Because again, depending on who you are and what you do, everyone has a different word for it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Let's now move into the, well, what else do you do? How else are you using your time to do the business side of things? And previously offline, we were talking about stocks. So you can go there or go somewhere else.
Yeah. the first time that I really started to conceptualize myself in a space that wasn't militaristic or sport was a dear friend from a men's group that I was in, who he was in surgical sales at a time where surgical sales was no longer a popular gig. And he's just watching his empire downtick. And he's watching his profit margins downtick. And he's watching his quality of life as he conceptualized it. Naturally, he's got a downtick. And in some ways, he's like, this is good. It's spiritually edifying to me. But on the other side of it, he's like, I still need to provide. So what am I going to do? And he came into my office on campus. I was in my study, and he came in and he's kind of just talking through this. And he's like, and so I think, you know, I think that's what I'm going to do. It's like, I'm just going to let it all fall apart so that I can get the value of being in that space. And I just looked at him and I said, so you're telling me that you're going to underperform for God? And he just stopped and he's like, I hadn't even thought about that. I had never considered myself a business consultant. I had never thought about coaching executives, but that little comment right there spurred him into Amazon, understanding Amazon's algorithm, finding a product that nobody was offering. And 3 years later, he's got a commercial on A&E for his product. And he's making millions of dollars a year selling his product. And he's been featured, if you will, as an entrepreneur. And it was all because of that initial comment. Like, you're telling me that your plan is to underperform. Like, that's your plan. And obviously, you know, there's been multiple iterations of this conversation that have gone on. And you know, the tide has kind of turned where he's now, you know, getting into me about starting my own consulting business and like, do it, bro, and blah, blah, blah. But that was the first time that I conceptualized being a coach in any different domain other than militaristic or sport.
So your royalties, is this ridiculous or?
I don't.
I was kidding. Yeah, you don't have to get into that.
I drink whatever wine I want to drink, and I am not short on ammo.
There we go. Both those things are positives for sure, especially in today's world, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
So let's dive into that then, right? This guy, this amazing man who you helped kind of propel onto this a great journey, like at least from a business standpoint.
Yeah.
He's now kind of on you, like, hey, bro, what are you going to do? So. Brandon, what are you going to do, bud?
Yeah. Here's the deal. The big kind of epiphanic moment for me is when I got out of coaching and I got the PhD, when it was time to go and do, the University of Missouri approached me and said, hey, build this for us. It was all laid out for me. Complete autonomy and authority over the curriculum. Come and do what you do. Build us a program. So that's what we did. We built them a program that 3 years into it was $1.5 million a year in revenue. Like, it was an amazingly successful program from an academic standpoint, not to mention the intrinsic value of the mission. Right? That gets its traction and the side hustles and, you know, all that stuff. And then all of a sudden Air Force Special Warfare says, hey, we need resilience. Come build something for us. And it's set up for me. Complete autonomy and authority over the curriculum. Go and do. This is a massively different space, man. There's nothing set up for me. There's nobody coming to me and saying, hey, I'm a CEO. I think you've got a great product. Like, boom, I'm going to set you up, go and do. You just have to get out there in this amorphous nebulous, unknown space. You have to conceptualize for yourself, what does go and do look like? And you got to go and do. And you start small. Like, probably would be good to have an Instagram page. Probably would be good to have LinkedIn. Probably would be good to create some content. And that's just the segmentation of putting yourself out there. And really, I don't know, maybe should you have an end in mind? Probably. Is it necessary? No. No, I don't, not at all. I don't think it's necessary at all. I think often that end in mind is so intimidating and so inconceivable that it paralyzes people, as opposed to, I mean, I think it's important to have an Instagram, so I have an Instagram. I think it's important to have a LinkedIn, so I got a LinkedIn. I think it's important to have content, so I'm creating content. I have an idea of what my audience is going to be, and I'm creating my content based off what I think that audience is going to be, and that's where I'm at.
I love that breakdown. Again, you go right back to process-based. It's not, hey, this is a big-time goal. It's where I want to get to, right? It is, if I do these things, something good's going to happen. If I keep doing these things, hey, guess what? Something good's going to fucking happen. So I love that, man. That absolutely speaks to me for sure. And
yeah,
it's something I try to drill into anybody I'm working with, whether it's, you know, tactical athlete, sport athlete, real estate person, whoever. You make enough offers on enough houses in the market you want to make, right? Your niche, whatever that is, multi, single, I don't give a crap. You make enough offers and you have your freaking financing ready to go. Sooner or later, you're going to own a bunch of houses and you're going to have a bunch of income. And then, you know what I mean? And then you can work on the next problem and the next problem. And Absolutely. That's how life goes. Yeah. So that's one question I got for you, Brandon, since I got you, and I clearly need as much coaching as I can freaking get. Yeah. The way that I put it to people, and this might be a terrible analogy, is that the best adults in my life, the ones who are most successful in their marriage, in their business, in their friendships, in everything, are the people who can handle the most problems and find solutions for them. Can you put that in a better cognitive performance coach standpoint so I can sound smarter when I talk to these people and not like I'm Sesame Street?
Elmo says, I could talk to Grover. I think by and large, what we're talking about ultimately is stress tolerance and the ability to have a clear end in mind. You know, a destination or an outcome that we're working to that is of value to us, and resistance comes in. And so if we think about it elementary, right? Like, we've got 2 minutes to hit 60 sit-ups. And for 90 seconds, we're smooth, you know, and we've cranked out 45. And in the remaining 30 seconds, we've got to get 15 reps if we're aiming for the minimum, which I know makes for a terrible analogy in our world, but you get my point. But we've seen it. I don't care what that number is. The last 30 to 15 seconds is when that event starts to impose its resistance. And the time up from the mat to the knees, it delays. And there's a piece where you have to push back against the resistance that the event is providing to you. You have to meet resistance with resistance. And I think that that's ultimately the best way to look at resilience. Nothing's going to just let you accomplish it if it's truly a valued end. Nothing truly meaningful happens in the confines of comfort. Nothing. So you should expect resistance from this pursuit. And when you get resistance, you should meet that resistance with your own resistance. And I think that that's how we know we're in a space of resilience. That's how we know we're in a space of a valued end. And at that point, it becomes truly that elite level skill of problem solving. And that's not something everybody can do, because let's be honest, if 10 days in a row I fail, I make the same mistake 10 times in a row, that is not resilience. It's a positive adaptation, right? That means I'm making changes and I'm instituting problem-solving strategies that actually work towards a solution instead of just continuing to fail and calling myself tough. That's just dumb. That's
one of my
one of my favorite ones from one of the worst sport coaches I ever worked with. Toughness is tough. And I was like, what? It's like, coach, when you say toughness, like, what do you mean? You know, like, what do you mean?
Yep.
What do you mean? Toughness is tough. You can't hurt steel, baby. You can't hurt steel.
I'm not taking the bait on this because you guys are going to push me 90 minutes into a complete diabolical construction of mental toughness. Can't stand it. I hate it. If I could outlaw it, I would outlaw it.
Yep.
But I'm not taking your bait.
No. So I always, when people would throw that, I always thought it was fucking shit. I just laughed at people. Like, you have no idea. I know who I'm dealing with now. I'm going to put you in the bucket. You just need that. You need the aluminum hat. Like, you're good. I got you. You're over here. You're useless to
me. You're bad boys too.
Yeah. Yep. So resilience, hardiness, right? And, you know, and again, like toughness as defined as a physical attribute, but you know, there's the innate characteristic, there's the learned coping mechanism, and then there's just the natural whatever. Hit me with some of this, because some of these people listening, again, they're trying to do something in business and they're taking on the struggle of an additional stressor, right? We talked about stress and, you know, stress tolerance, right? They're taking on these stressors of business and ROI, and they're learning, you know, ROI and EBITDA and my tax yield and my LLC S Corp, and they're learning all these things.
Yep.
Some of them naturally have stuff. Some of them develop stuff. Some of them experience stuff. So get into that a little bit, because again, I hate mental toughness as a word. So let's define it appropriately.
We could do a whole nother podcast on just that. Like, let's just debunk mental toughness and why it's complete garbage, but I'm not taking your bait. So let's stick on what you're talking about. Here's what I think all too often, and I don't know if it's pride. I don't know. Honestly, it might just be some people aren't as blessed with the network that we've been blessed with. I don't know, but there is a massive reluctance that I don't understand to reach out for other people's expertise. Like, if you think about Grant Cardone, okay, and the cat that he linked up with on email funneling, like, I can't think of his name, but he was a Division I wrestler. He's built an entire empire on this email funneling piece, right? Russell Bronson. So Grant Cardone is like, yo, man, keep in mind, like, Grant Cardone has helicopters and private jets. Like, he's a beast, right? And he hits up Russell Bronson, who probably has private jets and helicopters. I have no idea. Yeah. And he just says, hey, man, talk to me about this funneling thing. And all of a sudden, you're on Instagram and you're watching Grant Cardone and Russell Bronson on Grant Cardone's private jet. And Russell Bronson's teaching Grant Cardone about funneling and how to funnel customer activity into your product services. Those are two elite billion-dollar revenue people who saw expertise or who saw a need and reached out to an expert that met the need, and they came together. Why don't we do that? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know about content creation, but I know Dr. Megan Sullivan's got some really cool shit on her Instagram. So how you doing that? And all of a sudden she's sending me links on, like, here's what I'm doing, and you can pay if you want to pay, or you can just use the template. Now all of a sudden I have a framework for content creation. Backtrack just a little bit. I can't even conceptualize what it would look like to record myself on Instagram. Like, what does that look like? I don't want to look like a douchebag. You know what I mean? Like, and all of a sudden on my feed pops up a psychotherapist that I had been using for trauma. Not like, how do you help people through trauma? And I'm like, dude, I really like his style. What? It just so happens that he's got an entire library on how to do his videos just like he does. I don't have to conceptualize it myself. I have to take what he's doing and I got to put it in a frame that I'm comfortable with. And I think that's the piece, man. It's having somebody that you can reach out to for I am struggling with ROI. I'm struggling with understanding candles on stocks. I'm struggling with level two data. And what does it mean, best bid, best ask? And how do I use best bid, best ask to know when to dump this stock? Like, somebody's got the answers. And just because you don't have it, stop trying to figure it out on yourself to make yourself an expert. How about you just make yourself rich by asking somebody else who's already figured it out? And you've saved yourself all that much more time.
So one of the things I think you hit on, and so I deal with this not only in the job I'm in now, but in all the consulting and everything, is, you know, as I transitioned out of coaching direct athletes, I worked in consulting and businesses and all these things. I always looked at it. There was two things. One, there was ego, and it was either ego in terms of, you know, narcissistic ego in terms of, I think I know, you know, I'm not willing to ask. Or I always, and again, operationally defined in these very unacademic terms, it was narcissistic ego, or it was scared child ego. I can't do that. I don't know what to do, you know?
Unity.
So then the other one is, and those are kind of the two big categories I always looked at why people wouldn't ask. The other one is, I really think there's like this misunderstanding of, you're not the first. And yeah. I got that from strength and conditioning, specifically in performance, because I wasn't the first person to do the workout I wrote. Someone has put every exercise, the squat, the this, the that, every variation. There is not an original thing I have ever done. Right. In my strength and conditioning career, because it was all done hundreds of years ago, 1,000 different ways. Right. What I did was take original applications for the people I was dealing with, not original ideas. Right. And that original idea versus original application was something that I always say, even then I say probably 3 or 4 times a week in some of the meetings with some of the people I'm with, hyper intelligent, good souls, but they can't get over that hump of, well, we're not the first. Like, why are we trying to reinvent fire? You know, like, why, what do we, just go buy a lighter and just go burn it down. Like, what are we doing? Right. And that, you know, I always looked at it as, it's two types of ego, and it's an unwillingness to recognize you're not the first.
Yeah. Yeah. It. And I don't know where it comes from, but what I hear you saying is there's this need to somehow be the original authenticator of plan A.
Yeah.
And instead of just simply getting plan A provided to you and being keen and acute enough in your understanding to know that that's the direction to go, but that's not satisfying enough from an ego standpoint, because we want to be this authentic originator of our own destiny. And I would just challenge anybody, check out the video with Grant Cardone and Russell Bronson, because those are two pretty elite dudes who relied on the expertise of the other to take something that they had that was already at a high level and bring it to a higher level.
So do you think maybe that's what makes them elite, is their ability to put aside that thought process, that ego, that whatever? Because I can tell you the richest people I've ever talked to are the ones who are always like, hey, teach me about this. Or the most successful people I know, the highest level commander, the highest level sergeant major, you know, however you want to look at it, that guy comes up to me and says, teach me something today. I'm sorry, yep. What? Teach me anything.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hey, let's do this. Never done that before. Cool. Happy to teach you. Or, hey, did you know this? Blah, blah, blah. So I'll kind of go through that. But that just kind of clicked to me that, hey, you know what? These are the things that these people do. And that's why they're at the high levels, because they've been doing that for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, however long it takes to get to that level of expertise and knowledge, for sure. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. My apologies. I would be remiss to say, though, this is something that I've been thinking this whole podcast. Pretend I'm a young cognitive performance coach, right? I'm somebody who wants to be in the mental performance space.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got for me? Teach me, coach me, tell me what I need to do to be successful. Sorry, the whole thing, because you put out so many awesome pieces of like little wisdom for football coach, strength coach, kind of everybody. But how would you hone this in for anybody listening who wants to go into that space for mental performance?
Be humble, be hungry, and be smart. That's simple. Because the humble piece, they don't listen. so many of these young cognitive enhancement people, they just want to show how smart they are. Like they tell me what your problem is. Tell me something you're struggling with. And the moment that you say something that they have expertise in, they cut you off and they hijack the conversation.
But I got a PhD.
Yeah, sure. Good for you. Good for you. I mean, you like, it's not a big deal anymore. They're online everywhere. It's so congratulations. You have a very expensive book from Barnes & Noble. Nice job.
So do you see that same thing that, you know, I see it strangely. I'm sure Joe still sees it from, you know, having his toe in the industry whenever he does, is these young coaches or mental performance enhancement specialists, whatever term you want to use there, they come out and they immediately get this vibe. I don't know who the hell's teaching them this. They need to immediately create that content that you're talking about or create a name for themselves and do these things as opposed to going and learning and growing. So that's pretty common in your field as well.
100%, man, because it's, you know, theoretically what you've learned. And maybe you've taken some reps at a practicum, you know, and maybe you've taken some reps as a graduate assistant with the team. But man, if you're talking about the spaces that we operate in, you better listen. You better be humble and you better sit your ass in that contextual domain and you better observe and make sure that you absolutely understand conceptually how you should be applying the theory, because with these cats you ain't gonna get a lot of reps at all, and if you punt it out of bounds one time, that's your name and that's it. You get one name in this industry, and if you are able to maximize and you're able to execute and you're able to fix underwaters for somebody or fix drown proofing for somebody or you know, fix interpersonal integration, like you got a good name. But if that person sits down and all you got for them is, well, you know, you just need to breathe in and breathe out and you need to downregulate. And well, you know, what are you thinking about when you're on the pool deck before you've got those six underwaters? I'm thinking about how much I fucking hate these things and I don't want to do them. And well, you probably, you know, that's not very helpful to think that. Like that's a person that hasn't taken reps in that space. And so be humble is the big piece, and to be hungry. I don't think people can conceptualize the level of grind that comes with the space that we operate in, whether it's a strength coach, whether it's a college position coach, or it's some element of tactical strength and conditioning or tactical mental performance. I don't think people understand that there are times where that day starts at 3 a.m. and you are prepping for your brief and then you're meeting with studs and then you're doing morning accountability and then you're off to the pool, then you're off to the ruck, then you're off to strength and conditioning, then you're off to team building, and then you're back for active learning, and then you've got end of brief with the proctor and you've got the whole appraisal of how the day went. And then when you get done with that, you got two or three studs that need to meet with you because they got to get their shit fixed because the path to assessment and selection is 6.5 weeks long. And then when you get done with that, somebody probably needs to meet with you over dinner. And before you know it, it's from 3 a.m. to 7 p.m. and your only reward is to do that again tomorrow. So do you really want to be in this industry? Or do you just want to say that you're in this industry? Because if you want to be in this industry, that pace won't bother you. But if you're about saying that you're in this industry, first of all, your very lack of depth is going to get exposed, number one. And number two, this thing will not stop asking. And you're going to be brought into direct conflict with the thing that you asked for because you wanted to be in this industry because you wanted to say that you were at this level. And this level is asking more from you than you're willing to give. And it gobbles people up. We see it every day. They just can't handle the pace.
That is a fantastic. Sorry, that is a fantastic breakdown, man. That was well done for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only other thing I was
no different from college strength and conditioning either. You know, that's what it is for me at Special Warfare, but man, It was no different as a college coach. It's no different for any strength coach at the Division I level.
Yeah, no, how about this one? You'll appreciate this. So I'm working, and this is where the intensity of what we do, right, and what I used to do, doesn't manifest itself in the normal world, right?
No.
So I'm working on a project, couple $100,000 project, right? We have a third-party company helping support it. The project manager from the third party, right? We had this meeting at 8:30 a.m. Eastern, 6:30 Central, or 6:30 Mountain Time, excuse me, 2 hours behind. I got an email saying, basically, do I really need to be there? I'm not really that functional in the morning, and I don't really think that I need to be there. And, you know, I think my time could be better served when I'm more, like, when I'm more productive. And as politely as I could, because I had to be diplomatic, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not this person's boss. Yep. This person works for someone else. Where mm-hmm. there's a monetary transaction. So as politely as I could, without laughing at this person, literally laughing in their face, I had to be like, well, you know, in this particular case, you are useless and you don't need to be here.
Yeah.
But in the future, if you do, invest in some coffee. So, but it was one of those, like, so now, but again, what has that told me? That's told me, okay, I need to hold your hand. I need to make sure this gets done because I can't trust you to do it because you're just not that person.
Yep.
And most importantly, when, and again, in this world, right, it's not bullets flying. It's not plays being missed. You know, it's not a missed assignment in coverage.
Yeah.
It's the CEO saying, well, this was supposed to be done 3 weeks ago because we have this and this and this and ROI and money. What mm-hmm. the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, well, so-and-so doesn't like getting up. Well, yeah. Doesn't like getting up. They're not very functional in the morning. So we're a little behind.
Yeah.
Not an answer. No. So now I know. Again, like I know when I deal with people like that, it's like, okay, you're not the person. You can't get me where I need to go at the level I need to get there at. So I'm just going to hold your hand, cut your food and dip your food in some ketchup and feed it to you and then tuck you in. Go to bed. Okay, let's let the work, real work get done. Yeah. So, you know, there's people like that in the non-collegiate, you know, mental, you know, tactical space.
Sure.
So
sure. And there's people like that in the tactical space. I mean, it'll blow your mind where, you know, you guys are numbers driven. I'm numbers driven. Like, I'm not interested in mental toughness because it's not objective. Can't quantify it. Can't define it. If I can't define it, I can't measure it. If I can't do those two things, I have no idea whether I'm developing it. Mm-hmm. Resilience can be defined. It can be measured. We can have hard, objective performance behavior data. And we have data from strength and conditioning, and we have data from run ruck, and we have data from swim. And it was really interesting in this space to ask coaches, and you have to go through a couple of different iterations, help me with the data collection, right? And so they're helping with the data collection, and then I get back and start analyzing and inputting the data, and I'm like, no, that's not right. No, that's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. Like the calculations, the you know, if you're talking about the poundage or tonnage computations are wrong, and there's just data errors everywhere, and you're like, all right, well, that guy's not about this. And so you move on to the next guy, and then you're just going second and third order until you find a guy who's truly committed to the data because he understands it. So it doesn't really matter what the domain is. I think from a judgmental standpoint, this is going to sound terrible, but mediocrity is just easy. Man, it's just easier to do less because somebody else will probably do more because they care. And if that doesn't parse out mankind, we fall into one of those two pockets, in my opinion.
So
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. People can pretty much be split right down the middle, Thanos style, with one on one side and one on the other. Like, we all know which one we never mind. That's a whole different conversation for the Marvel Universe.
But raise the bar, lose the losers, lower the bar, lose the winners.
Yep. 100%.
So you've absolutely crushed the entire interview, and we don't want to take up too much of your time. So we're going to roll into the final part, which is our favorite three questions that we ask every single guest, so we can kind of compare apples to apples.
Sure.
Question number one, who coaches you and why?
My wife, because she's nice.
Is she sitting right there? No, not at all.
Yeah. No. Hold on. Do you need to rotate the camera? Should we call her?
She's in bed, man. Like, this is a legit answer. She's the most important person in my life because I run high and I run intense. And she is so diplomatic. She's been in higher education her entire career at a really, really high level. So she understands what is an emotional, visceral response, and she understands what's a tactful, diplomatic response. And I think fighting solves everything. So I have no problem with putting on boxing gloves and we will solve this, but that's not really how adults operate, although I think they should.
How about this? Let me jump in right here, because this is a Matt Powell that he'll appreciate. Mm-hmm. I was with a mutual friend of ours who's active duty and he's med boarding out this past week. And we're sitting eating breakfast. And he says to me, he's like, yeah. He's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, like when people say and do dumb shit, I can't just look at them and be like, get in the fucking room. Let's go. We'll figure it out. Like,
yep. It doesn't really work.
If we could do that, so much more would get figured out. Sorry to interrupt you, but I just knew, and Powell knows exactly the person I'm talking about, and you live it too in that space. So
yep.
And he literally sat there and was like, yeah, he's like, what do you do? I try and be nice to people.
You regulate your emotion.
Yeah. I give people the stare. I
don't know if you guys follow Formula One at all. Christian Horner is the principal for Red Bull, and he gets in some pretty nasty confrontations with people. And he has this just smitey little that's all he does. He just nods head and says, yeah. And it's like, it's really powerful. It's really effective. And it makes him look really cool. And it's like, I need to work more towards that instead of blue room, 10 minutes, bring your mouthpiece.
Yeah. Violence can't be the only answer, though. It's sometimes an effective one.
Yeah. So the wife is great at that. Man, she's just a beautiful counterweight to me. So I understand that often the direction that I want to go is probably too aggressive. And, you know, I've got kind of I'll call it maladaptive sense of justice, where I want to right the wrong and I want to call this motherfucker out for overtly lying. And she's always been able to kind of walk me 2-3 degrees of separation from that path and be like, yeah, I know you want justice, but even if you get justice, there's also political fallout for getting that justice. So do you really want justice? And I'm like, no, I think I just want to double leg them into a fire hydrant. So, anyway, answer the question is my wife. She's just got a great ability to counterweight me in every domain, physically, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually. She's an absolute rock.
Very nice. No, you joined myself and Matt with obviously having outkicked your coverage significantly. So,
yeah, when they meet me and they meet her and they're like, oh, wow, wow. Okay.
Yes. Don't worry. It happens to us too.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll switch gears on you. Totally different avenue. Number two. And if you need a second, take a second. What is the best thing you have ever purchased between $500 and $1,000? And that's open to any context, personal, professional, just period, you transacted 500 to $1,000 and you said, that's the thing.
Honestly, this may not be the safest answer, but at that price point, the best thing that I ever purchased was my first handgun. Yeah. I get it, the right to defend and the Second Amendment and all the beauty that comes from that. But honestly, it was because there was a part of me psychologically that was unlocked by shooting. The gaze fixation, the quiet eye, the attention management, any oscillation whatsoever in that finger, and it's going all over the place. And it's been a beautiful space for me to live within that perfectionism, and truly want to have three perfect shots in a row, all within the same MOA. So, from a self-care standpoint, something that truly is beneficial to my well-being as a task, the first handgun I purchased.
Very cool answer. Again, we've had, the reason we asked is the range of questions. Yeah. Right? We're able to use the question to hone everyone in while still getting variety.
Yep.
Great answer. And I love the way you brought it to understanding the intricacy of the moment. Not, it's a tool, but within the tool is the development of an intricate skill set, which bleeds into so many other, factors.
100%.
Matt, last one.
Let's bring it home here, Brandon. So the question is, how do you manage your own personal time, and how do you keep, and we're going to use this obviously very loosely, balance?
I have no use for balance. I don't have any value for it. I think it's a fallacy. And if in fact it was this thing that could be approached where 50% of my life is weighed out evenly with 50% of my work, then I would imagine that I'm probably not very good at my work. And that's not a great equation for me. The domains that we live in require a singleness of purpose, that I have to master my craft to be the best in the business at what I do for these cats to have a chance to make it through the hardest and longest pipeline in the world. So I'm okay with being unbalanced. How do I manage my time? I understand largely that from 3 a.m. to 7 p.m., Air Force Special Warfare owns me. And that when I get home, I have a very clean ritual. I pull in to the driveway and I don't arbitrarily 1 to 3 minutes where I have to unpack that day. And this is my language, I have to leave it in that fucking truck. Because when I walk in that door, I've got 3 dogs and I got a wife who has nobody in San Antonio. She has no support group whatsoever. We gave up everything to come here. And she is looking for somebody to express to her that they appreciate her. And drown proofing and underwaters and, fill in the blank political shit at work, like none of it matters. That woman wants to know that you love her and that you appreciate her. So that's that piece where I see it, and this is not romantic at all, but it sets an urgency for me when I say, that's my second job, man. Like, I've got a job as the director of performance psych for Air Force Special Warfare. And when that stops, when that suspension hits at 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or midnight, whenever it is, then it's time to be a husband. And that's a second job. And I see it romantically in that responsibility. I think it's important to integrate more than it is to balance, And so is there a way for me to handle the demerit data or some case study work notes or something like that with her at the pool? So it's not that she goes to the pool and I stay here and work. It's that, we can kind of integrate both of our responsibilities along with something that we want to do. And honestly, man, the best thing that I do is I sleep less. It's super helpful on Sunday that if I can knock out 6 hours of work from 4 to 10, and then we can go to church and we can go to brunch, and maybe there's some cleanup while she grades papers. Maybe there's some cleanup, but by and large, like, the work is done and we can have a day. It makes a massive difference to her. So that's how I manage my time, is I sleep less. And I know that's a terrible answer, but that's the reality for me, is sleep less so that there can be greater integration in the places that I want it to be.
You're talking to a guy who slept for about 3 hours a night for 3 years to finish his RD. So yep. I'm with it, brother.
Yeah.
I'm with it.
Yeah, I mean, the research is kind of interesting on this, not to take us too, but like, for people who get less than 8 hours, the only variable that moderates whether or not that came with some type of terminal illness or effect are the people who felt like it was bad that they weren't getting 8 hours. It's really cool research.
Sure.
And I personally, like, I'm not going to say no to 8 hours, but I don't need it.
Yeah.
I mean, last week we had a 23 hour day. I got 1 hour. The next day I'm like, this is not normal. Like, I was fine. And that was a 21 hour day. And I was fine. I'm like, okay. So I'm a guy that just doesn't need sleep.
I'm just not mentally tough enough for that. So.
God. Yes. If only we were in North Korea and we could ban English.
So, Powell, let's go back to something he said earlier, right? We know you're not mentally tough. It's a given.
Right.
Nutritionist, you know, whatever. Sorry, that was an easy shot. That was an easy shot. But one of the things people say it all the time, right? And to use the layman's term, right? When you enjoy what you do, the work doesn't matter. The time goes by, you know, you don't recognize it. But I think one of the things to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, right? I'm stealing words beyond my academic and, you know, professional understanding. The task-directed focus of getting the job done. Hey, like, this is just what's necessary. I always look at it, it's just what's necessary. Like, I would fly out with one team, fly back with another team, sleep on the couch for 2 hours because it was better than going home, and train the third team over here and do this and, you know, here and bup. Like, you know, the other day I flew in, got into bed at 2, and at 5:30 I had a 2-year-old climbing on my head.
Yep.
He wanted to play. He wasn't going to be like, I couldn't say, hey kid, you know, I'm just not good right now, and I need 2 more hours. You know, It was, Dad, get your ass up. Come play with me,
yeah.
Or I'm going to burn the house down while you're not paying attention to what I'm doing. So which one do you want? You want the house burned down, and you want to play Legos? Like, okay. But again, like, it's task-directed focus. I woke up, he's jumping on my head, greatest thing in the world. I wanted to be asleep. I wanted to be in bed. Greatest thing in the world, because he's my kid. It was awesome. So just get up and get it done.
I guess what I would challenge you with is, would you not say that was preceded by values committed action? That you had that task directed focus, because that dude coming in at that moment, that's a values conflict. Like, do I want to be asleep? Yeah, 100%. Like, am I tired? Am I smoked? Yeah. But this is my little man asking me to play Legos.
Yeah.
Like, and there's this millisecond dilemmatically of like, what? And then, boom, values committed action. And now, because you've made that decision, now you can have a task directed focus, because you've made that values committed action, and nothing else exists in that moment.
Yeah.
Joe, this man just came on our podcast and coached you midstream. challenged you in the middle of our podcast. I love it.
Part of the reason why we're doing this, because again, if you're not learning, you're dying. If you're not learning, you're dying.
Amen.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
man, you have been nothing short of fantastic. You came highly regarded and highly billed by Dr. Megan Sullivan. Yeah. Make sure you go check out that episode to anyone listening right now. But man, you absolutely crush it. Please tell us where people can find out more about you, and then we'll get out of your non-existent hair.
Yeah, it's if you don't have a lot of time, it's a cleaner cut.
It looks fantastic. It looks fantastic.
I get a lot of Jason Statham autograph requests.
Ooh, that's solid right there.
True story. We're in Taiwan, and they come up to me and they're like, "You, Mechanic." Mechanic. I have no idea what you're talking about. They're like, "You, Mechanic," and they're like asking me for an autograph, and I have no idea what's going on because I haven't seen the movie. And then they pull up Google, and it's Jason Statham, the Mechanic. I was like, "Ah, it's not me." They still wanted an autograph.
So dude, you should have rode that way, bro. Yeah, Mechanics.
Yeah, I have no idea how expensive scotch was over there. Had I known, I would have rode that way. Santori. Yeah. Instagram is dr.brandonorr. It's really simple. That's the handle for Instagram. And then LinkedIn is brandonorr, PhD. And those are the two spaces where I operate the most. Clubhouse, if people are familiar with that, it's starting to gain traction. And that is just, it's Dr. brandonorr on Clubhouse. And I'm in a number of different chat rooms that are pretty much all related to mastery, mental performance, high performance. That's a big buzzword on Clubhouse. So those are the three avenues that I spend as much time on as I possibly can.
Awesome. Hey, thank you again for coming on. Joe, you got anything, my wonderful co-host?
No, I got nothing. Again, this was awesome. We didn't get super, super deep into business ROI, but like we said, as we were talking, it's more, how do you mentally get to that point? How do you choose to make some of those choices and realign your values? You know, how do you keep focused? So while we didn't go super deep from an analytical number standpoint, again, it's the first step. You know, you have to actually make the move to do those things, and you have to be able to do that. So there's so much value. And again, I hope people don't take this episode for granted, because you know, it wasn't a numbers episode. We weren't talking ROIs and what's the market rate versus it. You know, no, like that's a different thing. This is just as important, but in a different way.
Yeah, and I, to that point, I don't know. In reflecting and preparing for the episode, I was trying to think, like, how many different side hustles have I managed at once? And as I look back through my notes, I've never had more than 4 side projects at once. And so then I just started thinking about, like, why? Well, because I'm on a positive spin, I'm incredibly thorough. Mm-hmm. Like I want as much depth as possible. But on the other end, I'm also incredibly inefficient. Like I can make an email last 2 hours if I need to and or want to. And maybe it's because it's not my sole source of income, but man, one thing I would tell people is less is more, because the fact that I've poured into those 4 people, because I can manage the time, it's a digestible chunk for me, has probably produced tenfold in business for me, because I did such a great job, because I was so thorough with them. I wasn't spread thin. I could give them 90 minutes if they needed 90, because I didn't have another person stacked up right behind them in 60, 60, 60, 60. So I think there's some real value there in terms of making sure, I guess that it's a manageable load. And what dictates it being manageable is the excellence that's poured into each entity, more so than the quantity or the volume or the ROI.
Well said. I think we're going to end it right there, because nothing else to be said.
All right, gentlemen. I appreciate your time, guys. This is awesome. Thanks for having me on and sharing your space with me, for sure.
Thanks for coming on, brother. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, guys.
Until next time.
Got it. Cheers.